This is The Big Web Show, featuring special guests and topics like web publishing, art direction, content strategy, typography, web technology, and more. It's everything web that matters. The show is hosted by none other than Jeffrey Zeldman, creator of the internet, the man who discovered electricity. I'm Dan Benjamin. We'd like to say thanks to today's sponsors. The first one is Sound Studio 4. It's created by the guys over at felttip.com. This is one of the most amazing sound editing, audio recording packages available anywhere for the Mac. Go check them out in the Mac App Store or felttip.com. We'd also like to say thanks to MailChimp. These guys make sending newsletters as easy as could be. You can send 12,000 emails to 2,000 subscribers every month for free. Check them out at MailChimp.com. Bandwidth for this episode of The Big Web Show is provided by Midas Green Technologies. Virtual private server submerged in oil. Seriously, check them out, MidasGreenTech.com. So what's going on there? How's New York?
New York is splendid.
Is this Paris. A good time of year to be in New York?
This is a fantastic time. The heat is wonderful. It's great in the parks. The sun bakes you, and it's lovely. It's a great time to be on the river. It's a great time to take a ferry. It's a great time to read Smashing Magazine.
It's Why a great is time. That?
I don't know. It's a great time to read the User Experience 500. Power 500. Do you know what that sounds like? It sounds like a supplement that you get like at a supplement store, right? And there's like some picture of a guy like 30 years old, but like massively muscular, but like right. with the hair thinning. Slightly, you know how they go totally after that demographic?
Oh, yeah. A lot of those guys.
Because the 20-year-olds don't have to work out. They can eat donuts all day and they're still hot. It's the 30-year-olds and the 40-year-olds. It's like, you know, you start losing your hair. You're like, oh, I got to work out now.
Right. I was talking to a couple 20-year-old women today in their mid-20s. They don't have any problems.
Yes, they do.
Well, they don't talk about it.
I had so many problems at that age, didn't you?
Mental problems. I mean, I'm talking about physically.
Oh, no, physically, no.
They just wake up. They can work. They can sleep 4 hours a night, work all day, exercise, whatever they want to do. They just go do it. It's fine.
Yeah, but I was crazy.
Well, so I probably all 20-year-olds something. 20-somethings are all crazy. Mm. They don't feel crazy. And then when they're in their 30s, they look back and say, man, I was crazy. A couple old men here today.
One of my favorite tweets, I forget who wrote it, just a woman wrote about her husband. She just said, 18-year-old Jim is in 18-year-old Jim weeps while 30-year-old Jim stands in the shower with a naked, soapy woman talking about his workday. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Did you write that?
I didn't, but I wish I had. It's pretty good. It was even better the way she wrote it. It was actually much better. So, responsive design.
Is this about responding to design?
You just got the book. What did you think?
I haven't read the book yet, but I think the book is beautiful.
Well, they're always beautiful. Okay, so you haven't read it, so we're not going to talk about responsive design.
No, let's talk about it. Teach me about it. Save me from reading this book.
I think we'll get Ethan back on.
We need to. What was his problem today? I thought he was going to be on today.
Well, the problem was I invited him at 3 o'clock, and the show starts at 3 o'clock, and I hadn't consulted with him. So he was in a train in Boston on his way to meet a client, I believe. So
wow. I thought – so he still does this client work periodically. He's not fully solvent just from the book alone yet.
Well, I wouldn't want to get into that, but he does client work because he's a web designer.
Okay.
And he's doing...
I need to write one of these books. I think I'm in the wrong business. My understanding is you write one of these...
Are you in a business?
That's a valid question. I feel like you write one of these books and you can just kick back and coast for about a decade.
I don't think that's true, but I do think it's true that designers need to write and UX people need to write and developers need to write. I was having dinner the other night with some friends and one was talking about career problems, and she's really wonderful, but she doesn't write at all, doesn't even blog, and blogging can be an art form, as we know, but it doesn't have to be. I think people get daunted by the idea that they have to, you know, have as many readers as John Gruber or, you know, be as witty as Merlin Mann, or they shouldn't be blogging. And that's just not true at all. I think when you share your knowledge, there's always people who learn from it. There's always someone who's going to learn from it. And I think that's just a really great way to advance your career and, more importantly, give back, you know, be part of the community. Otherwise, I think you feel really isolated. You just go into the job where you're the only IA or you're the only developer or whatever, or you're one of two developers, but the other one doesn't understand why HTML, CSS, and JavaScript need to be separate, right? So you really can't communicate with that developer very well, and you just feel all isolated. I think blogging is a great way to feel less isolated.
Does it matter where your blog is? Can you just do something on Tumblr these days, or do you have to?
Sure, why not?
I don't know. I mean, for years and years, people were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on domain names. You've got Zeldman.com. That's pretty convenient. But what if you didn't have it today? What if you were just starting out? Would you still, could you just go and get Zeldman.tumblr.com or whatever and blog there? And
sure, that's why not? Sure, why not?
What if Tumblr gets bought by Microsoft and you don't want to be associated? You don't want to be whatever.blogs.microsoft.com. I mean, it's not in your control.
Owning your data and all that. Yeah, I do think a personal domain is best.
So not only do you need to write, but you need to craft a brand then. You need to craft a brand.
Again, I think I agree, but I think, boy, we're just jumping into it. That's good. I agree, but I think if you say you need to craft a brand, it's kind of like the reason people don't write fiction is because they think they have to write a novel like Hemingway. And since they don't have Hemingway's talent, at least not yet, and they've never written anything longer than a short story, they just panic. I don't think looking at something that's already achieved, that maybe 20 years went into that, you know, the making of that, and saying, well, I have to have that and I can't have that, so there's no point to it. I mean, it's kind of like never having played the saxophone and listening to Charlie Parker and going, oh, well, I guess I can't do that. No, you can't play like Charlie Parker, but right. You might learn the... You might take some lessons on the instrument and learn to produce a sound. You might learn to produce a sweet sound. You might be able to play, Mary Had a Little Lamb in a couple of weeks. That might be nice. You know, and eventually you might be musical enough, you know, be as good a sax player as David Bowie. Right? Worked for him. Not many people know that or remember that, but he's a saxophone player also. Did you know that?
I did not know that. I mean, it makes sense if you think of his earlier music. Was he playing it on his early stuff?
Well, he played the saxophone parts and he played the simple piano parts and simple guitar parts, right?
Then he'd have someone sit in and do the solos.
Well, he'd have Mick Ronson or somebody like that. Yeah. So he'd have. No, there weren't really. You don't really think of saxophone solos when you think of David Bowie. That's really not where.
Oh, I do.
You do?
Sure. Cool guitar riffs. I mean, he had these great guitar riffs. Freaky stuff that didn't sound like anything else at the time.
That was Mick Ronson. Bowie's a chameleon. Bowie had many phases. I saw someone described his early stuff as a wet hippie phase, which I kind of liked. I'm not sure why wet. Wet hippie. It makes you think of a big dog that's been out in the rain.
I was reading that piece you wrote, that thing you wrote about Cameron Diaz.
Yeah.
That was a great piece. I mean, does that count for what you're talking about? Does that count as blogging? Does that count?
So that was a personal piece about something that happened on the street, something that took like 18 seconds on the street that takes about 2 minutes to read.
That's the best thing I've read on the web in a month.
I think if you can write, I don't think that we need like a million more posts about responsive design or a million more posts about what is user experience or whatever. I mean, I think there is a lot of repetition and there's a lot of sameness, and that can cause you to get drowned out. I think if you can write something meaningful about your kid or your mom or your dog, you know, or your, you know, that might be great too. That might be the way that you get that you build a community with posts like that, and then, you know, listening when people respond. I wrote something. I don't remember what it was, but it made like all these people cry. I don't really remember what it was.
I cry every time I read something you write. Could be on any topic.
No, my accountant cries.
I think you've written, what was that piece that you wrote not long ago? It doesn't matter. Any one of it your just, personal, and this is I the just, this is the thing. I remember, I'll go back, I'll say this again. I remember the time on the web when all of the sites that I cared about, I would just, every morning, I would open them all up, and it only took about five windows. This is before tabs. Yeah. About 5 to 10 windows, I'd have every site that I even cared about, every site that mattered on the web, and open them all up, have them right there, read them, and every day there'd be some new post. What's Zeldman's new post? Whatever. And this was like, it wasn't, you know, it was just, it was amazing, that landscape that you could contain in it, what today we would call tabs, but back then it was windows, right? You know, in 5 to 10 windows, you had your finger on the pulse of the web and you knew what was going on.
But we didn't have the user experience power 500.
That's right. So many things have changed now, and there's so many different directions. I was talking with somebody the other day, and they were commenting, and my life in these shows, it's kind of blurred. I no longer know if I had a conversation with somebody in person or on a show or what it was. Everything's sort
that's freaky.
Run together now. Right. So I apologize to whoever this was that I was talking about, but they were saying that today becoming and I specifically made a note that I wanted to throw this at you. But they were saying that 5, 10 years ago, it was easier in some ways to become a web designer or a web developer or even a programmer perhaps than it is today, because today, in order to really call yourself, let's say, a web developer, to really step out and embrace this field, you don't just need to know HTML. You need to know HTML and CSS. You probably need to use some tools like Photoshop or Fireworks or whatever the current thinking is in that space. I sure don't know what it is. You need to know that. You probably need to understand responsive web design. You need to know bulletproof web design. You need to understand accessibility, user experience, user interface design. I mean, you can't just like learn one component. You probably need to understand JavaScript too. You might need to understand how to integrate with PHP or Rails. I mean, these are all prerequisites now. Where do you start in 2011?
Well, nobody's
like, crazy.
Well, again, I think it's the same thing as what we were talking about 5 minutes ago. You don't start there. You don't go from 0 to 60. You don't go from, I'd like to learn a little something about web design, to mastery of all these different areas. That mastery or that knowledge of those areas comes with the passage of time. I mean, this is definitely a field for people who like to keep learning, no question about that. But there's tons of stuff I don't know. There's also the fact that initially, if you're good at one area, you can work with other people who are good in complementary areas, right? You don't have to code like your hero or design like your hero, you know, or maybe you're good at editing. Maybe you're good at graphic design, or maybe you're good at user experience, but you're not, you know, you're not the best at choosing colors and that kind of thing. I think people have complementary talents. It's nice to have a bit of all of it. It's nice to understand a bit of all of it, but I certainly don't think everyone has to be able to do all the things that you listed. And certainly not right away. I think you learn about those things as you're working and decide, I seem to be better at front-end development than design. I like them both, but maybe I like front-end better, let's say, as an example.
Yeah.
And then maybe you learn a little back-end, but it's not all or nothing, and it's not immediate. I mean, I don't know. You know, how do you master the flute? There's like 11 holes on a flute, right? There's the and that's all there is. So that's not hard to master. But, you know, there are people who play it their whole lives, and they're better at 70 than they were at 50, and better at 50 than they were at 40. And how is that possible? Or, you know, Milton Glaser hasn't really changed tools as far as I know. I don't think he does that much computer stuff. I think he still uses the same tools he used 20, 30 years ago. But he probably feels like he's learning and getting better every day. I mean,
It just seems daunting. Like, I don't feel like I'd be comfortable in 2011 walking up and saying, well, I just know HTML. I don't really know any CSS. I don't know any. I don't need to know any. I'll figure it out later. But I'm really good at HTML.
Because if you enter the job market at 21 as a web designer, you've probably played around with HTML and CSS already as a kid, as a teenager. You've probably already done some stuff. Maybe you did a WordPress blog, you know? I mean, maybe you actually did some programming in WordPress, you know, so.
But on my checklist here, to be a web developer, here's what I have going. To be a web, even just, let's not say developer, let's just say web designer. In 2011, here's my checklist. You have to have all of these things, or you have to be working toward all of them, it seems like. HTML, CSS, user experience, user interface design, JavaScript. You need to blog. You need
content
to speak.
Strategy.
Content strategy. You need to blog. You need to speak. You have responsive design, bulletproof design. You need to attend conferences. Right? I mean, any of those not? You need to understand accessibility. You need
you
to
need
potentially
to know things. You know, you need to know something about all those things.
I would say you need to probably know a lot, especially if you want to be one of these people who goes out on their own, who's independent. I almost feel like it's easier to be part of a team today than it was, because if you were a web designer 10 years ago, you probably were like the one guy or girl that did this. You were the one lone person. You were like, oh, she's our designer. She does everything. We don't understand any of this. She does everything. She represents us in all of these meetings. And by the way, we don't pay her enough, and we don't ever listen to what she says and make the logo bigger and use the blink tag. You know,
it freaked me out when I got a job as a creative director at a .com agency in 1999, and someone else was writing my HTML. I was really uncomfortable.
Really?
And they were really good. It was really good. It was the guy who... He would go on to develop Futki. Do you know Futki? It's the Russian, it's basically the Russian Flickr, except it predates Flickr.
Huh.
And it's really nice, different emphasis, a slightly different user base, but it's a really great photo site. And, I designed something and handed it to him. And I said, this has to be in a pop-up window. Right? Mm. And then he came back and wasn't in a pop-up window. I said, oh, maybe I didn't make that clear. It needs to be in a pop-up window. He said, pop-up, no good. I said, but we have to make this in a pop-up window. He said, no, change the design. No good. You know, and he was basically giving me the kind of usability crap that I used to give other designers.
Right.
You know, but I felt, oh, now that I have this job, I have to be fancy. Now that I've got someone else doing my HTML, I better do a really fancy website that loads in a pop-up window. And then the developer was like, no, that sucks. We're not going to do it. I mean, I think the best way to start now probably is to work somewhere where you can work with other people and learn from them.
Oh, I would agree with that. I feel like you have to.
Yeah.
It's almost easier today. I feel like this. I feel like it would be easier to be a developer today than it would be to be a designer.
Or web designer, what do you mean?
I mean writing code, programming versus being in the designer. It just seems so daunting to me. The idea of trying to learn all these different technologies where, yeah, sure, there's plenty of technologies as a software developer that you've got to learn, and plenty of APIs and plenty of things, but at least you can pick one language to learn. I'm not saying it's easier to write code than it is to do design or vice versa. They're both hard. They're both hard in their own way.
To be good at anything is hard.
But like, if you just pick the language, let's just say I want to be a C++ developer. Like, you can just learn that one thing. You can learn C++. And yes, there are tons of other frameworks and APIs and other things that you'll have to learn too. But at least you can just write C++ all the time. Like, you can pick that one thing to write all the time, and you can just write that. And it almost seems like it'd be easier to master that. Are we seeing that in web design? Are we seeing people who are coming out and saying, and maybe this is a bad example, you have to tell me, but are we seeing people who are saying, well, I just do the CSS part, or I just do the HTML and CSS parts. I don't do these other things. Somebody else on the team will do these other
things. I think there's a lot of people who just do HTML and CSS.
And that's it.
I think there's a lot of people who do HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And the JavaScript, they always feel like they're kind of winging it.
Right.
They're not really expert. You know, they're not really programmers. There are also people who design, you know, who design and do HTML and JavaScript, and, you know, learn just enough how to work with jQuery or something like that to make things happen.
Mm.
You know, copying and pasting,
right,
and changing a variable. The way we all learned HTML. Right? We all learned HTML, copying and pasting,
yep,
even if we read books about
and,
it.
And probably JavaScript, too.
Yep. I don't know why. So I get what you're saying. There are a few. I actually think if you're a developer with C++ or, you know, if you're a front-end web developer with HTML and CSS, I mean, it's not this endless thing, really. You don't have to be, you know, we have different people doing back end and front end.
But now if you're, let's say you go into meet with a client. The client says, here's the site that we want. And we have this old site. We want it redesigned. And these are the new things that we would like it to do. And you sit down and you figure out how this is going to work. And then you assemble a team. And in the past, it seems like the team would have been, you know, a couple, maybe two, three people who did it, each of whom probably did everything. And it was almost like, okay, you know, who's going to do what? Who wants to do what? And now it almost seems like you'd have to have a team just like, you know, Danny Ocean assembled the team. Well, we need one person who does this, one person who does that, another person who does this. And nice. And that's how you have to do it today in 2011, because you're never going to find a few people who can do everything or do everything as well today, because there's so many different things.
Well, we try to bring everyone to the kickoff meeting. We don't line up a gig with just one person talking to a client.
You get everybody in there.
We don't get everybody in there, but we get a lot of people in there talking to the client early on. Yeah, definitely.
What do they wear when they go into this? Is it very casual or is it like suit and tie?
I wear a suit and tie.
You look good, though.
Thanks. I have to. I'm old. I have to wear a suit and tie. I don't know.
Is this a New York thing, do you think? A big city thing?
No. No, but there's definitely statements made by dress code, you know.
What does that say? You're rolling with suit and tie. What does that say?
I make the most money here.
Right. I make significantly more than these other people. You're borderline wasting my time, but I'll talk to you.
It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean, well, it certainly doesn't mean the last part, but I think it means, like, I don't know, like, I think the senior people have to dress up. It's a sign of respect. And then the junior people, everyone kind of expects them to be cute and edgy.
Tattoos people would be disappointed.
Yeah,
and
people would be disappointed and by junior, I don't mean really junior. I just mean, they may be junior or they may be mid-level, but they're still, you know, younger, and they're supposed to be edgy and look creative. I think there's a nice, I don't know, I there's some point where I just stopped looking. Well, there's still like this tiny hint of creative in I don't just wear I don't go to Men's Warehouse to get a suit. You know, I have
do you have like a custom?
I do. I go to Al's Attire in San Francisco on North Beach, and they measure you like no man should measure another, and then they make this suit that's like that fits you like butter, like someone just put butter on your naked body. It's so freaking comfortable, but also like you design it with them. So they have all these old materials, like really wonderful materials from the 50s, right, or from the 70s, and I'll just pick out something that has an amazing texture, and then we'll look at buttons. I've got a shirt with like buttons of like the Jewish people being sent out of Rome. You know, I don't know. It's like crazy. I really pick stuff that if you look at it, like I've got a pinstripe, but the colors are not traditional pinstripe. The width of the pinstripe is unusual. There's little orange lining inside. It's got little rockabilly elements to it, but they're very subtle. So I still, you know, it's like I dress like I'm a creative guy, but we're a serious company and we know you're spending a lot of money and we're taking that and your business very, very seriously. You can trust us. And they want that. And then they want, you know, the CSS person or the designer to be, you know, tattooed and look cool. And the people in between, you know, wear a tie but jeans. I mean, it's funny. And I see the same thing happening on our stage too when we do our conferences. Like I wear this suit, I wear some, you know, and different speakers depending on where they are professionally dress cool or they dress cute or they dress up but not that far up. Do you know what I mean?
So you wouldn't go pick something up off the rack and wear that?
I wouldn't now. With what they expect of me at this stage in my career and this stage of what they think our company represents, if I were to pick something off the rack, there would be something cut rate and unconsidered about it. I didn't think we were going to be talking about fashion, but I actually have to dress like thought went into it. And because I love it. I love the way it looks. You know, I love the way I look in that stuff.
Now, do you think...
Then I don't look bad. But I look at myself in that and I'm like, hey, nice.
Don't some of these clients, though, like see you on Twitter or Facebook or Flickr or wherever and you know... And they see you wearing your United Pixel Workers, Zeldman, you know, New York. That's okay, though, because that's not to the meeting. They don't expect you to dress this way on Sunday afternoon while you're, you know, while you're walking your dog.
Anyway, Roger Black shares a studio with us, or I share a studio with Roger, however you want to phrase that. And he dresses immaculately all the time, and it's amazing. He's like a real classic art director and unusual character. And he just dresses brilliantly all the time.
Like a suit and tie or?
Uniquely, yeah, like that, but very elegant and dapper and unusual.
He seems like the kind of guy who could pull off an ascot.
No.
He could pull that
off. A Barney suit. I don't know, but I can't do that. If I did that all the time, I would be too tired.
Do you ever wear like the blue blazer with the white sailor cap?
Oh, hell no.
I
can't do anything that feels like Sunday school. I dressed grunge to my jobs. You know, I always dressed, going back all the years that I've been working, I wore like deck shoes and I really dressed like a punk. I dressed like all these things. So now I dress like a successful creative person, but the creativity is, you know, it's understated. Everything's understated. I dress like I hope we design, like elegant, understated, perfect, but not, you know, not screaming, look at me, subtle.
Do you think people notice that? Would somebody notice the difference between, let's just say, a nice suit from a nice department store versus the custom thing that you fly out to the coast to get?
I think women notice. I don't know what other men notice. I think there are some men that would notice and some that wouldn't. I mean, guys, I spent a long time kind of being blind to this stuff in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, being really aware of design in all these other areas and then being like absolutely stupid about fashion, like blind to it. I don't know why. But it makes a difference. I mean,
so if you go in, you get your key people together. You go into this meeting. You're wearing this cool suit, and if I'm like your, you know, your usability guy, user experience guy, coming into the meeting.
Yeah.
Can I wear a t-shirt with the ripped jeans?
No. Big blazer. Maybe a dark blue shirt with a big wide pink tie that's like got a beautiful pattern on it. It's a gift from your wife. And assuming you're male. I'm assuming, lots of assumptions in that sentence, but...
You're talking about me.
I was thinking about one of our user experience people.
Sure.
So. But maybe jeans.
Could it be ripped jeans, which the kids wear?
No.
Somebody shows up like that, do you give them the eye and say, look, dude, you got to go home?
No.
We never
had a problem. Never had a problem. So I guess we're talking about meetings and making good impressions.
Well, I think it all. This is all part of it. This is all part of it. I know so many. Here's something I remember. I'll tell you a little thing about Dan Cederholm. Dan Cederholm, he's great. And there was a period of time where I was doing, heavily influenced by some of my mentors, you included, when I was doing a proposal to get the client. I would spend days, if not weeks, on a proposal, and I would hand them some massive, 30-page tome that I hoped would express to them both the kind of work that I was going to do. I mean, look, if I would spend that much time doing some massive proposal, then clearly I will have the same kind of tenacity on the job if you hire me.
Right.
So I would. That was one part of it. The other part of it was I wanted to be comprehensive. I wanted them to know what I was proposing and what I would do and what I wouldn't do as part
Absolutely.
Of the job. So I would do this. And I remember asking Dan Cederholm at one point, I said something to him like, would you be willing to, I'm trying to update this proposal. I've been using the same sort of framework for my proposals for a long time. Would you mind sharing in typical fashion? He said, of course, I'd love to share. He sent it over. And it was like a one-page thing with like a paragraph and a couple, points on it of like how much things would cost. And I said, this is what you said. And meanwhile, nobody doesn't know who Dan Cederholm is or know his work. It's astoundingly great. And I looked at this thing, and I looked at this stuff that I was doing. I was like, this is what he has like his small clients are MTV. I mean, he's doing such huge work. This is what he sends to me, and he gets the work, and he's like, yeah, it's no problem. I was like, man, I really need to rethink the way I'm doing stuff. Has that changed? This was years. This was, I don't know how many years, 10 years ago. Was he just ahead of the curve on that back then, and I was old school?
Maybe so. I when I was doing directing a lot of the hands-on client services work out of New York, we would write proposals that were just masterpieces. Erin Kassane was our content strategy person and our editorial person, and she and I would basically, with feedback from everyone else and like getting everyone's input and how long will this take, but we really wrote these lush prose treatments, right? And then we beautifully typeset it and all that, right? And the Philly office started going the other way. They were ahead of the curve. The Philly office started basically having long conversations with potential clients about what they might need, and having so many conversations. So you have to demonstrate that you get what the client does. You understand their business. That's what you were doing with those long documents. That's what I was doing with those. Publishing is now facing a blah, 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 blah. Retail gizmoidotrons are, the market for gizmos has changed. Talk about their business problems. Talk about their users, what you know about their users. Obviously, you're going to learn more. Obviously, get information from them, like find out what research they've done, find out what they know about their users, and then you'd write all this long stuff so they would understand, wow, this is not just, and that used to help us get work.
Yeah.
Because somebody else would send an undifferentiated boilerplate.
Right.
Acme Web Development Inc.
Right.
Will give you a blog on the following, whatever. Right. It's totally cookie cutter. So we didn't do that. We went the other way. We basically, it's like we wrote a novel it's like writing a novel so a woman would marry you to show her that you understood her. Writing a novel about her, and by the time she finished reading the book, she would cry and marry you, right? Like that. That was how we approached it, and it worked. Now we don't do that at all. And now what we do, we have lots and lots and lots of conversations, ask lots of questions, bug you, really, finding out everything we can about you. And then we end up with a proposal that's kind of like Dan Cederholm. So it's a few pages saying, here's what we're going to do. Here's, here's the fee. Here's what you get. Here's, But we don't have to talk about our philosophy about multiple iterations because we've already had that as a conversation. We don't have to talk about why user experience is important. You know, and we may include a pamphlet listing things we've done before, but that's already on our website. All the case studies are on our website. So we don't really want to hand people a long PDF or a big bunch of pieces of paper. I mean, I miss that in a way. I hated writing them, but it was really hard. I don't know. It's funny. We just had an issue of List Apart at listapart.com this very week.
Yeah.
A double issue on proposals and RFPs. Right? Have you seen that?
It's a brand new issue. Just came out.
Yeah, it just came out on Tuesday. Yeah, but I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Nathan Peretic. Peretic? Peretic?
Peretic sounds right.
Peretic
sounds like heretic, and that could be right.
It's more of an old... I don't know if old school is the right word, but he's talking about how to write a really good proposal, one that stands out, how to basically answer the questions, understand the anxieties the potential client has, show that you understand them, show why you're the right team to solve those problems, right? And Greg Hoy has RFPs, the least creative way to hire, it used to be called the least creative way to hire creative people, but basically the least creative way to hire teams. Why RFPs? I mean, we all get them, but why they're a pain in the neck, and why what we might do as an industry to try to move away from that? Because it's true that when we get, I mean,
companies come to you specifically? I mean, I would imagine they would. They'd say, "Oh, we want these guys to do it. How much would you guys charge us to do this?"
So two things happen, right? For anybody, as you start getting a reputation, whether you're like super famous or locally famous or whatever it is, whatever level you're at, there are people who hear, hey, Jenny Schwartz at Schwartz Consulting Inc. is really good to work with. So they say, hey, Jenny, we heard you're good to work with, right? Regardless of the level of it. People hear you're good to work with, or they hear that you're a creator, or they know something about your company and that's what they want. Those things, those overtures from companies can often lead to successful engagements because the person's actually looking for you and what you do. Now, they may be talking to other people who do specific things too, right? Kind of like a band. Like if a band was auditioning guitar players, right? They may be talking to three very different guitar players, and they're not sure which guitar player they want, but they're all,
right.
They're talking to people who each of them have, man, this cat's really good on rhythm. I'm going to embarrass myself if I keep going with this metaphor, so you get the idea. But they're looking for different things. Where you do poorly is when you get an RFP and they are just sending it out because you're local or because they need a third bid, or because they heard you won an award, or because someone told them that I don't know anything about web design, and my friend runs a gas station, and he worked with you, so I'm reaching out to you. And right. You don't want to turn down business. You don't want to say, oh, sorry, if you haven't really heard of me. You can't do that, but it's a fine line. We find generally when people reach out to us because they know what we do, and they think they want that, or they're at least considering wanting that, that can lead to a really good relationship. And if they don't know who you are, but they've heard of you kind of vaguely, it's often a mixed bag.
Do you think that's got to be a sign of success, though? When you're just sitting there and you get an email from somebody that says, would you please consider taking this project on?
Well, they don't put it like that.
Please, I beg you.
Yeah, they don't do it like that.
We know your work, and we're so impressed by what you do. We'd be humbled and honored if you would consider taking on this project at any cost to us.
Okay. Yeah, that doesn't really happen. But what is interesting?
Have costs become more competitive? Do you feel like now when you send out a proposal or a bid that there's competition there? If for price, that price is the issue?
Price is always an issue, and you're always competing on price. But I'm going to tell you what I tell everybody. Just raise your price. Raise your price every year. Lou Rosenfeld told me that. Steve Krug told me that. That's what we do. And and it works.
Is it a percentage? Do you go with a certain percentage? Is it just...
No, it really depends on your situation and what you're comfortable trying to get away with. I remember what I had a client call. We went through a long negotiation with a client years and years ago. And I bid the job out at $40,000. And then I didn't hear from the client for a year. I forgot about the whole thing. And when I say bid it out, I mean we wrote, we worked weekends, wrote this 40-page proposal, demonstrated understanding of their business, all that stuff. So a year passes and suddenly, I'll call him Francois and say that he wrote from France. That could be fiction. But he said, hello, we want to work with you. And so I said, sounds good. And we go back and forth. And then he said, so what is this going to cost me? And so of course, I quoted him $80,000. And he called me. He said, okay, it looks really good, and I think we're going to do this. I really shouldn't do the French accent.
Mm.
And
I like it. It's not as good as your Russian one.
They're all the same. They're all the same accent. He said, I think we're going to do it, but tell me, last year you said this would cost $40,000, and now it's $80,000. Why is that? And I just my heart stopped. I had this total panic. I was sweating. And then I heard myself saying to the phone, well, we've raised our rates. And he's like, okay, fine.
Oh.
And often with corporate clients, it is fine. You're charging too little. I mean, later I found out we charged way too little. In fact, he told me. There are jobs, there are certain situations where the job goes to the lowest bidder regardless. In some nonprofit situations and in some federal and state situations, they are legally mandated to choose the lowest bidder. And that can be very frustrating. For example, an organization, a government organization, might really want to overhaul their website, which is inaccessible. It has to be accessible. And they might really, they might really want a solution that's, web standards focused and, user experience focused. And so you might come in the middle on that bid, and they have to legally go to the lowest bidder who they might have been told you have to give this to this person for some political reason. You have to ask this company for some political reason. They might have gone to that company, and that company, might be a lot cheaper and have no idea about accessibility and they might be stuck in table layouts or using JavaScript on every page, and the page doesn't work without JavaScript. That still happens in 2011. That still happens, that there are people doing work where if you don't have JavaScript, you can't use the site at all, which is crazy. If they've never heard of progressive enhancement, they don't care. So they, and yet that's the company, sorry. I always make these things personal, and I shouldn't. But that can be the company that gets hired to do an accessibility site. And because the government wants to look like it's conserving taxpayer dollars. So, did you see there's this new government website about containing spending costs? Then they spent $8 million on this website.
Wow.
Which is this.
Wow.
If anyone who worked on it is listening, I'm sorry, but it's, in my opinion, not a very good website. And, they've got a $16 million contract, so they've got another $8 million to spend in the next 2 years adding some kind of features to it. But it's tragic and comic, so I don't know. Have you done much government work? Have you done much consulting work for government agencies, programming work for government agencies?
No, I never, with the exception, I worked in a foreign aerospace company that did government contracting early in my career, but
a foreign aerospace company?
No.
You said four.
Four.
Oh, I thought you said a foreign aerospace.
I would never know. And I didn't have clearance. I most of the people I worked with had clearance. I didn't have any clearance. So I didn't know anything. I just ran the computers. Which is funny if you think about it, because I although I never did anything, I had access to all of the data. Everything, anything I could have ever wanted to see. I never looked at anything But should I have wanted to, I could have. And there were situations where I was cleared to do that from the standpoint of my job. Like, if I had needed to look at something, I could have. I wouldn't have been bad for me to do that, but I had no clearance. And there were people in there with, like, secret clearance, working on secret things.
That's very
scary. The system administrator, me, who had access to everything, had no clearance.
I don't think that's unusual.
It's scary.
It's very scary, yeah.
But I was a good kid. Never looked at anything.
I know.
We had a big safe. Do you have a safe? Can you have a safe in a New York apartment? Or we'll go right through the floor. It would fall right through the floor.
Right through the flimsy plywood floor?
Yeah.
Killing the rats and cockroaches? You have this... New York's actually very nice, you know.
Yeah, well, you keep saying that. I trust you.
You know, the weather was lovely when we started this, but this huge storm is happening now. I'm up on the 23rd floor looking out at the New York Life Tower, a 1923 architectural masterpiece, and the sky is almost black around it. It's just very murky gray.
Like in the Ghostbusters.
Yes, it looks like Ghostbusters out here. Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's Ghostbusters out here. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it could be intimidating for somebody to think about starting this today, 2011. Where do you go? I think what we're going to see, if it's not already the case, is just continued further specialization and specialization in the space of web design, the way that we've seen it in the space of computers, down to the point, not just, oh, I'm a C++ developer, I'm a Ruby developer, not like that, but like, I'm a C++ developer with a specialization in robotic vision. You know, that's what I do. Oh, that's interesting, because I'm a Java developer who specializes in embedded antenna design.
Perhaps, but I think what's really wonderful in this field is to be a generalist who can be a specialist. And so here's what I mean. Alfred Hitchcock started as an art director. Alfred Hitchcock, the great film director, started by designing title cards in the silent era. He was an art director. So he worked with type, and he sort of thought of like little visual puns sometimes to set, you know, or little techniques that would help the audience better understand what's happening in the story because of the type that he picked, or, you know. And then he worked his way up from that. He was the light guy. He worked, you know, he worked sound when that came in. Actually, no, by the time sound came in, he was already a director. But he learned every craft. He learned to do it lightning right by my window. Awesome. Can you hear the thunder?
I do hear it.
Okay. He learned every bit of, so then when he was a director, he basically sat on, you know, he sat on the floor with the script, but he knew what everyone was doing, and he knew if they were, you know, and they might be better at their jobs than he was. You know, the light person might be better than he was when he was doing that job, or the camera person might be better than he was when he was doing that job, but he really understood what they were doing and what they had to do and what the constraints were. I think that's a great way to be, if you can learn a little something about all
really
of it.
Great way to think of it.
Yeah, I try to think like that. I try to, you know, do you remember when I started Jeffrey Zeldman Presents? It was like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and I had that little fathead profile and everything.
So good.
Okay, so I always kind of like, I draw career inspiration and creative inspiration from, not just from design and web design, but from all, you know, and I love film. And so I just, you know, I get a lot of inspiration from music and from film and from writing, right? The three big ones. And I love Hitchcock. And I, you know, his mastery over what the audience is thinking and feeling at every second, just by where he puts the camera. You know, he wasn't a director's an actor's director at all. He hired good actors and just let them do their jobs. He didn't tell them, you know, and the method actors hated him. Like Paul Newman hated working with him, right? Because Hitchcock didn't give him anything. He'd just say, could you try that again a bit faster? You know, or you're supposed to be standing here. When you give this line, you should be here. And he expected that the actor would do their job and fill in the rest. Anyway, not to get too into Hitchcock, but
didn't he invent that shot, or at least he popularized
it? The simultaneous
yeah.
zoom in, pull out.
What is that called?
The vertigo shot.
Yeah, I love
that.
They
do it all the time now, but yeah. So he...
Love that shot.
So he had the camera change focal length in one direction while it was being hoisted mechanically in the opposite direction, so that when Jimmy Stewart looks down the staircase, when Jimmy Stewart has vertigo, looks down the staircase, and you know, in this San Francisco, you know, flight of just like endless flights of stairs in an right. office building, and then later in a church, it just it seems like the stairs get taller, and they use that all the time now, right?
Yeah, you know, it's almost like the stairs. The background seems to be moving. The right. the main the person is somehow not moving, but
Spike Lee does it a lot.
They did that in Buckaroo Banzai, Across the Eighth Dimension, even. It's everywhere.
You know who else? Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Our generation's Hitchcock, right? Martin Scorsese does it.
If I was doing a shot of you and I had a moment where you were about to, you know, you were realizing something important, I would use that shot.
Yeah, or I would do the opposite. I would just put the camera somewhere. I would do what Ozu did. I would just leave the camera, never move the camera, and have the actor sit there and not act.
Yeah.
And just have the audience in some Zen process understand suddenly, oh my, the character has realized something profound. I don't know what accent that was supposed to be.
That's
I guess
good.
Japanese. So, you know.
That was the Japanese element.
That was sad. Well.
You getting any photo shoots done?
Photo shoots.
Yeah, you're always getting some big cover shot done.
No, nothing like that.
All right.
Well,
it's going to be on Wired.
It's been a lovely day, and
we got to wrap this, don't we?
I think we should. I think we should.
I feel like this could go on. And you know, here's what you're thinking right now. You're thinking, man, this was a bomb. But I'll tell you what, we're going to get more positive feedback on this episode than any we've ever gotten.
I was thinking it was a nice episode.
Well, then we're going to get terrible feedback.
Sorry.
I like this. I like it where we probing Zeldman, the mind of Zeldman. What's it going to take to get you to post your desktop screenshots again? What's it going to take? Emails?
I can do that for you. I can do that for you.
Yeah, I love those things. It's like how does he think? It's like crawling in your head and making myself comfortable.
I know you're sincere, and
I'm very sincere.
I appreciate it.
All right, well, that's it. But we'll be back next week. Who are you going to get on next week?
We'll tweet about that in advance.
Okay. Well, have a good week, sir.
You too. Bye, everybody.
Bye. That about does it for this week's episode. Thanks again to our great sponsors, Sound Studio 4 from Feltip.com and, of course, MailChimp.com for making the show possible. Thanks to you for listening and tuning in every week like you always do. Go to 5x5.tv. You can hear previous episodes of this show and all the other shows that we do. And we've got new ones coming out all the time. If you like the show, rate it on iTunes. Helps us find new sponsors, helps us find new listeners. And that about does it. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back next week.